Welcome to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. This show will first be broadcast on Wednesday, May 20th, 2026, on 91.7 FM WHUS Stores. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician, with my co-host, Ron Meniza. We're coming to you live from beautiful Mansfield Hollow, Connecticut. Comment below to let us know you're here and ask questions. You can also email me at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to the show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, Spotify, Patreon, and Buzzsprout. You may also watch the recorded Facebook Live episodes at Fran Storch ND for 30 days, and also on my YouTube channel at Radio Naturopath. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. The information presented on this show should not be construed as medical advice or direction. If you're having a medical condition, please consult with your physician. I just came back from Florida, and that was exciting, and I actually did quite well in terms of the heat. When I rode my bike, I made sure to get out early, although I didn't necessarily get out as early as I would have liked. The thing is, on the west coast of Florida, the sun rises at least an hour later than it does here. I think it's rising in the 5 a.m. hour here. It's like rising at 5:30 right now, and it's rising at 6:45 there because they're further west. And when you're closer to the equator, the day length, there's not as much variation in the day length between the summer and the winter. So they get less hours of daylight than we do in the summer, and they get more in the winter. And so like the normal curve of their day length is flatter than ours. So what happens there is that, you know, in the longest days of the year, their sun rises later than ours. That plus the fact that they're so far west, like where my mother lives in Venice, Florida, is it's if you drew a straight line up north, you'd be in eastern Ohio. So they also will probably have a later sunrise than us. So the problem is it gets really hot there. It's May in Florida. May, June, July, August, September, October gets very hot in Florida. And you really don't want to be out in the sun. Well, unless you tolerate it, you don't want to be out in the sun after, like, between noon and 5 o'clock. It's so hot. It gets so hot. And you certainly don't want to be exercising in it, again, unless you're used to it. So I did manage to do okay. I figured out that if I drove my bike to somewhere to start, when I would get back to my car, instead of just, you know, gradually unpacking and getting back into the car, I'd open up the car, turn it on right away, crank the AC and sit in it for a bit, and then drink off my water bottle. And that really worked. And then I would sit there for a couple of minutes and get cool. And then I would pack up the car. And I had no problem with, you know, close to or actual heat exhaustion like I did the last time I was there in the heat. So I was very pleased. We'll see if that happens again in September. We'll try the same methods again. And, you know, I didn't ride for super long, but I managed to tolerate the heat. I was pleased. And now, here in Connecticut, for the next few days, we're going to get 90s. We're going to get, I don't know if we're going to see 90s today, but we're going to probably see 90s Tuesday and Wednesday this week. So very exciting, you know. And then it's going to drop out to 60s and 70s and rain. So we're getting a taste of summer, and then it's going to go away. And I think by the weekend, which is Memorial Day weekend, I hate to say, so we won't say right now. The outlook is meh. So anyway, so I'm really working with electrolytes, trying to figure out which electrolytes I like. There is a major brand of electrolytes. I'm trying not to mention the brand name, but they now have a lower sugar version that has no artificial sweeteners in it. It does have stevia. It has sugar and stevia in it, and the whole bottle, the whole good-sized bottle, it's 16 ounces or 20 ounces or something, the whole bottle has 50 calories in it. So it doesn't have a lot of sugar, 50 calories if you're going to drink the whole bottle down. And I wouldn't drink the whole bottle down in a sitting, so I am enjoying that. And I find that that's very good for helping me rehydrate after a workout. What you want to look for is if you are exercising and you're sweating a lot, then you want your electrolyte to have a higher salt content. And then for everyday electrolytes, you want a lower salt content, because the idea is that salt, you're sweating out salt. If you're sweating a lot, then you're losing salt. So you do want to replace that salt. If you are doing just everyday electrolytes and you're not particularly sweaty, but you want to hydrate better, then the thing to do is to look for electrolytes. First of all, that have no added sugars. Second of all, that have no added sweeteners. Third of all, if they're flavored, well, they can have added sweeteners. They just don't, they just should be natural. So you can get electrolytes that have stevia added to them. And I think that's fine if you like that. And you want, if they're flavored, you want the flavors to be natural. And then you want it to be not super high in sodium. So if one of those stick packs has sodium in the double digits, that's pretty good. For me, I don't necessarily use a whole stick pack in a 16-ounce glass of whatever I'm drinking. So there are electrolytes that are meant for every day, and they'll even say on it they're meant for every day. And that's something that you should look for. And again, make sure that they don't have artificial sweeteners in them. You want to stay away from sucralose and S-sulfame K and stuff like that. So the other thing you can do is get completely unflavored electrolytes, and you can, it has no flavoring, no sweeteners, no color, no nothing. And then you can add them to whatever you want. You can, you don't have to just put them in water. It'll make your water taste a little bit like seawater, but you can add them to your iced tea or your iced coffee or your hot coffee or your juice or whatever you would like. You can add unflavored electrolytes to anything. You don't just have to have them in water. The problem is this time of year, drinking plain water may not cut it for you. And especially if you're finding that you're drinking lots and lots of plain water and you're running for the bathroom all the time, you're not holding on to it. You'll find that you have less trips to the bathroom if you use an electrolyte that has some potassium in it. And you want it to have a decent amount of potassium and not so much sodium. So that's what to look for, and that's for your everyday electrolytes. And everybody's going to be different as to what they can tolerate and what their needs are. If you're someone who has POTS, postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome, where you stand up and you get really lightheaded and your heart rate goes up really fast, you're going to need electrolytes. You're going to have less POTS symptoms if you use electrolytes. And the reason you get POTS is because there's a dysregulation of the autonomic nervous system. There's a dysregulation of the vagus nerve, and the vagus nerve has a relationship with the hypothalamus, and the hypothalamus controls hydration and how that works for you. And if your vagus nerve senses that there's not enough circulation in your brain, it's going to make you go down. It's going to make you not want to stand up. That's what's going on when you feel lightheaded. Your body is telling you, you don't have enough circulation to the brain, so get low so that I don't have to work as hard to get circulation up to your brain. The better hydrated you are, the easier it is for your body to get circulation into your brain. So staying really hydrated. That's why Susan Weed says, don't drink plain water ever. She doesn't drink plain water ever. Now, her solution is to drink nourishing herbal infusions. And she doesn't necessarily add salt to them, but she probably puts some good quality Himalayan salt in the broths that she makes. And, you know, when she makes broths, then she uses a lot of wild weeds that are very nourishing. But, sure, her everyday nourishing herbal infusions are going to have things like nettles and oat straw and linden and and red clover, all of those things, and those are very nourishing. And you'll find that if you can taste something in your water, you're more likely to drink it. I find that that's true of me. And you also are going to have a preference as to the temperature of your water. I'm a cold water girl. It doesn't even matter what time of year. I could be cold, but I prefer to have cold drinks. I will have hot drinks in the winter when it's cold out. But if I want to have a glass of water or a glass of water with electrolytes, I want it to be cold. And this time of year, forget it. I need it to be cold. And I do find that if I'm feeling lightheaded, a cold drink will make me feel less lightheaded. And cold stimulates your vagus nerve. So that's good. I also find that mint stimulates my vagus nerve. Like if I'm feeling a little lightheaded, if I go brush my teeth, I feel better. And that's the mint. Mint is stimulating to the vagus nerve. And also, if you are just hanging out and you're feeling a little off, not necessarily nauseous, but maybe a little nauseous, but not necessarily nauseous, you're just feeling tired and woozy and or maybe a little headachy, before you assume that it's something bad, that you have Lyme disease or you have something absolutely wrong with you, before you assume anything, go get yourself hydrated. Have a glass of water have a glass of water with electrolytes and drink water and or water with electrolytes and drink a fair bit of it and see if you feel better. And if you do, then it's dehydration. And dehydration, you at this time of year, you really have to stay on top of your hydration. When I was in Florida, I found that I really had to stay on top of it, that it was really easy to dip into. I don't feel so good because I'm dehydrated. And I'd find that when I felt off like that, I would go get hydrated and I'd feel better. And so it's really, well, when you're in Florida and it's hot all the time, I think that's how people manage it. They always have some kind of fluid with them and they're always sipping on it. My mother even always has fluid near her. She's always drinking something. My mom almost never drinks plain. I haven't seen her drink plain water. And she drinks stuff that I probably wouldn't drink, but that's okay. At least she's getting some fluid in, right? But I like to sip on iced tea and maybe matcha latte. Like I'll keep some in the fridge and I'll sip off it during the day. And I try not to do too much coffee unless it's a really good coffee place. I had a few coffees when I was in Florida because I have a couple favorite cafes down there. Even though I have a couple favorite cafes here, I have to limit my coffee. The combination of too much caffeine and stress will give me a migraine. I figured that out because I had no migraine symptoms or no terrible exhaustion symptoms while I was in Florida because my stress was lower because I wasn't seeing patients. Patient care is probably the most stressful thing that I do. So I wanted to encourage you to make sure that you stay really hydrated. How are you finding your hydration situation, Ron?
My hydration situation is weird.
Yes.
That's probably the best I can put it. You know, I just looked at this and I researched if your body can adapt to hot weather. And according to the information I found, it takes about 7 to 14 days of regular exposure to temperatures and physical activity.
Right.
So that would put you going down to Florida.
Never getting there. Right.
Situation.
Right.
Because what happens is you improve your sweating as you are adapting. So it learns to sweat more and produces more sweat. And then it also increases your blood volume because your plasma volume increases.
Yes.
Which expands your circulatory system so your heart fills faster and doesn't have to work as hard. It lowers your heart rate. Your resting and exercising heart rates decrease compared to when you're unacclimatized. And better temperature regulation. Your core body temperature is lowered, allowing your body to tolerate heat stress and without working as hard. So people who are living there
have gotten used to it,
which is what happens to us when we get all hot here in the summer and then all of a sudden we get a cool day and we're like freezing to death because there's that period of, you know, we've been so used to being adapted to the heat. And it goes both ways because it always feels like a 60 degree day in the summer always feels a lot colder than a 60 degree day this time of year.
Sure. That's right. Because your body's there is a real physiological acclimatization that happens
in either direction. That's exactly what it says right here.
Wow. That's really interesting.
So
anyway. I never make it there. But when I go visit in September, I should do better because I've been in heat here.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. That adaptation would be much easier to transition to.
There's not necessarily an adaptation because it's been hot. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
And yet, I didn't go to Florida in September, October last year in 2025. I went in 2024 and I did not do well. It was so hot. I think that the difference in the heat here was just that much different. But by September, October, I don't know if it had cooled off enough or it was just so much hotter there. It was actually unpleasant. That's why I kind of wish sometimes my mother would have been a snowbird.
It would be nice if she would just come up here in the summer.
And a lot of people do that. They do the snowbird thing.
A lot of people
stay down there in the cold weather and they come up here for the summer. And she was talking about, remember Shirley? Nice Shirley from New Hampshire? Well, guess where Shirley goes in the summer?
Well, you know, and the smart ones spend 182 days up here, and then the 183 days down there.
Because there's a tax break.
Yeah, there's, two and three, that would be 365, right? Yeah. So if you spend most of your time being the 183 days down in Florida, then you're taxed and officially living full-time in Florida.
Florida, right.
Right. And that's a thing
that, and you get a tax
the
benefit.
Real snowbirds do. Right.
Right. who figured that out? Yeah. All right. And you have been getting cramps.
All the time. They're back. They're back. And that's really maddening to me because I do spend a lot of attention on hydration.
Right.
Thinking that that is going to help solve the problem. I also have at least one 22 to 25 ounce vessel of electrolytes every day.
Yeah.
And I'm also taking magnesium.
I wonder if it's the wrong electrolytes.
Maybe, or maybe I'm just not absorbing the electrolytes correctly, and that's part of the problem that I'm having with some other things. But I can safely say that before I had my surgery on my neck, I was having multiple cramping problems all day long. And I'm getting close to that same level.
So we don't know if this is coming from your neck.
I don't know.
Right. So there might be a way to check that.
I have an appointment coming up, and I'm going to address it because my hands are a mess. Well, I know why my hands are a mess. I'm using them a lot lately.
Yes.
So I'm putting my hands through a lot of hard labor, and so therefore there's that. But why my feet are cramping up on me, and my calves, and my quads, and my hamstrings, I have no idea.
Right, so we don't know if you've got some stenosis going on. So they're
going
to have to.
Something's going on. Yeah.
So that's a possibility, and it's also a possibility that the electrolytes are not effective. And one of the things that I have read is that there's a compound called glycerol, which is a relative of glycerin.
I just read about that. Yeah.
That glycerol is something that can help you to absorb your electrolytes better. And glycerol has all kinds of other health benefits and benefits for exercise and stuff. Like it's been studied to be really beneficial. So you can get, there's a brand of electrolytes that you can get that contains glycerol.
Okay.
And it's pricier than other brands of electrolytes,
I don't
of course.
Care. I mean, really, at this point,
I don't care. I'll give you the name of it.
Because
we can get that. And the other thing I was thinking of is just buying glycerol. If you just buy separate glycerol and add it to your favorite electrolyte, you could do that, too.
I could do that, too.
Yeah. So
that might be a less expensive way of doing it.
That's right. And I was thinking of doing that because I want to try the glycerol, too.
Okay, so get some of that, and we'll mess with that and see what happens.
Meanwhile, I'll give you the name of the product that has the glycerol in it. And if you want to buy that, you could buy that. Okay. I'll get the plain glycerol, and we'll start messing around with the plain glycerol.
Yeah.
So we try not to say brand names because we have a rule about...
We're not supposed to.
Yeah, about recommending... endorsing because this is community
radio. This is not commercial
radio. Right, exactly. So that's why you hear us saying there's a brand of and not, us not telling you what it is. I think we might be able to say brands as long as we're not endorsing them. But we try to be careful about that. So that's why you're hearing that. So good luck with your hydration. Ron is going to look up what he can find on glycerol. And if you wanted to experiment with glycerol, look for a brand that contains glycerol or look for separate glycerol and add it to your favorite electrolyte, whatever that is. And then, like I said, the glycerol has other health benefits to it. Mm. So maybe you'll talk about the other health benefits.
A simple non-toxic sugar alcohol.
Right.
Right.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yes. Do you see health benefits there?
Sure. Let's see. Yes, there are health benefits here.
Yes.
Skin hydration is one of them. Hair care also. That's why it's found in conditioners.
Right.
Believe it or not, it's also found in some lotions and soaps. And
it's probably a humectant that if you put it on something topically, it draws water to it. That's why it would be good for hair and skin topically.
and it's used in food and beverage as a solvent, sweetener, and preservative.
Right. What right. about glycerol with electrolytes?
Glycerol. Looking, athletic
there
performance.
You go. That's what we want
Hyperhydration.
To know.
Some athletes ingest glycerol along with water to increase total body water, which aids in thermoregulation and endurance during exercise in hot environments.
That's great.
So that's a good thing.
I think it's helpful right? for exercise performance. I might do a deeper dive into glycerol next week.
Right, because there's a lot of things here it talks about.
Yeah.
So there's a ton of information about it.
Yeah.
But, you know, I at this point, I have always been concerned that I have absorption problems.
Yes.
For a long, long time. And I think it improved dramatically when I stopped eating gluten.
Yeah.
I think that made a big, big difference.
Yeah.
But now I'm fighting a battle with it again, and it just seems like annoying.
Right.
More than anything else, I'll say annoying.
Right.
There's nothing worse than waking up with your body going into cramps.
Right.
And not being able to get yourself even in a position to straighten yourself out
right.
to release the cramps.
So you have to talk
really
to
difficult.
Your neurosurgeon about whether could there be some pressure on your neck.
That's what I'm concerned about. Is maybe there's something going on here, because you know, I with that clinic that I did this past weekend, I'm just still not very comfortable on my bike.
Right.
And it's really really hard for me to get in a position that I am comfortable.
Yeah.
So that has a tremendous amount of concern to me,
right.
of course.
And were you upright on the bike?
No, I brought my road bike.
You brought your road bike and you still have the drop handlebars.
So I was down a little bit and you know, I could do it, but after a period of time on the bike, I get really stiff.
Yeah.
And uncomfortable because I can't keep my body in that position for very long.
So here's an interesting thing. One of the things I've been reading about and being advertised to is that, so, you know, I had surgery to help spinal stenosis, and the surgery that I had was simply a laminectomy. I did not have a fusion surgery or a TLIF, which is where they go in sideways and they put in a cage to separate, they put in hardware to keep your lumbar spine open. I haven't had that, but I did have a lumbar laminectomy, and the concern there is that when you take out some part of the ligaments in there, because I'm missing a ligamentum flavum at, I think, L2, L3, to make more room. The concern there is they cut into a particular muscle called the multifidus, and the multifidus muscle runs along your lumbar spine, and when it's strong, it keeps your lumbar spine separated, and it keeps it from collapsing. So when you have a fusion, they cut through that multifidus. I don't know if they cut into my multifidus, but I know that some of the exercises like if you do the balancing table exercises where you're on all fours and you lift up the opposite arm and leg, and I use a hand weight in the hand that I'm lifting up. So balancing table exercises help to strengthen the multifidus, and so does dead bug. And when I do dead bug, And I'll encourage you to look up dead bug and balancing table on YouTube so you can see what they are. And they help to build the multifidus muscle. But in dead bug, it's kind of obvious because you're lying on your back and you have all four limbs in the air like a dead bug. And then you kind of walk in the air. So you're walking opposite arms and legs, and you can hold weights in your hands, and you don't have to, and those strengthen the multifidus muscle. You can also buy devices that stimulate the multifidus muscle for strength, and those are, if you go online and you ask anything about strengthening this multifidus or spinal stenosis or anything, this product's going to get advertised to you. I actually have it, and it's a neurostim. It's a neuromedical electrical stimulation device, and I haven't been using it consistently, so it would probably be a good idea for me to do that. And now that I'm back home, I'll get back on my PT exercises. So stimulating the multifidus muscle is important. Strengthening the multifidus muscle is important when you've had repair for spinal stenosis, because they They go by it. They either hit on the nerves that strength that enervate it, or they cut through it. I don't know if they did that with me, if there was any cutting or moving aside of the multifidus muscle. Mm. So you did not have a spine. You did not have a lumbar surgery. You had a cervical surgery.
Right.
I wonder if there are spinal muscles along the cervical spine that they cut into that are not strong, and that you need to be doing something to strengthen those muscles. So something, I don't know if there's a multifidus in the cervical spine, or there's, you know, there's definitely spinal muscles, paraspinal muscles along your neck that you could be strengthening, and that may be part of your problem, that you need to strengthen them to keep that to keep your neck up, and if you're having any collapse, it might be related to that. So you could talk to your neurosurgeon.
And I have been working with, you know, physical therapy on that, and, you know, and drawing myself back more, like, so when I'm down in the drops on my handlebars, we're trying to figure out how to verbally put this together to explain, because of the radio show. What I do is I pull my shoulders back, and when I pull my shoulders back, it lifts my head up.
Yeah.
But that also goes directly to my lower back muscles.
And were you told that you have lumbar stenosis?
Originally, yeah. Well,
so
but
you
that
may...
was a long time ago.
Well,
that was over a year ago.
But that, just because they fixed your cervical stenosis, doesn't mean you don't still have lumbar stenosis.
You
may.
I don't want any more operations.
And you don't have to get,
right.
You never have to get up. Well, you had to get an operation for your cervical spine because that was dangerous.
I was on the verge of living in a wheelchair.
That's right. But lumbar stenosis, lots of time, depending, unless you have caught Aquinas syndrome, which is where you have so much breach, so much pressure on the spinal nerves that you can't move your legs and that you lose bowel and bladder control. If you're not there, if you can function through your spinal stenosis, lots of people don't get surgery for spinal stenosis. And you can also have visible stenosis on the MRI and have no pain. I am just not that lucky. Although I am wondering if I am improving, because I seem to, you know, I went to Florida. When we went to Florida in January, I had a lot of pain after we rode. I am better now. I was able to ride more and ride stronger and manage. Like, there are things I have to do to manage the pain after I'm done with the with the bike ride. I mean, I have to do my angry cats, and so angry cats are a good exercise to do after you'd go on a bike ride. And if you have any kind of stenosis, if you have herniated discs in your lumbar spine, angry cats are a good thing to do. So I'll explain. So Crossroads, when I go to Crossroads, the gentleman there, one of the PTs there, he told me, after you go on a bike ride, what I'd like you to do is prop up some pillows or an exercise ball, a big inflated exercise ball, and I want you to lie on it prone with your lumbar spine the highest point, and just lie there and relax for a while.
Right.
And the reason to do that is because you're going to open up your lumbar spine, and the discs that may have been sticking out while you were sitting up in the saddle will drain back down. And so the problem is, I tried to do that, and I don't like the pressure on my belly. If I have anything at all in my belly, which I'm going to have at least water or protein shake or food or something in my belly before, when I lie on that ball or pillows, it presses into it, and I can't stay there because it's uncomfortable. So that's unfortunate, because the thing is, if I could lie there, I can just breathe and relax and let it happen. You know, I could play TV or music or something and just lie there for 5 minutes or 10 minutes or something. But it's very hard to do. It's much easier, they also told me, because I have scoliosis on the left side, and, you know, the stenosis is worse on the left side, that I could lie over a bolster or a pillow with my L4 at the highest point and open it up. That's no problem, because there's no pressure on my belly.
Right.
So what I did instead is, thanks to, I think it's David Middow, you can find, he's a physical therapist on YouTube. He gave me some very basic super basic exercises, PT exercises to open up for spinal stenosis. He's like, we can help you and you will not have to get surgery if you do these. So anyway, I have my PT exercises from Select and I have my PT exercises from him and also from Will Harlow, who's a guy in England. So David Middow, his thing is do angry cats. And so angry cats as opposed to cat and cow. When you do yoga, you do cat and cow. So cow is where you are on all fours and you lift your head up and you arch your back with your tummy downward. And cat is where you arch your back so that your back arches upward. And you alternate those two. So it's debatable whether it's a good idea if you have lumbar stenosis to do cow at all. So when I'm doing cat and cow in a yoga class, I don't go up very far. I'm mostly flat. But when I do the cat, I exaggerate that and I try to hold it. So if you just do angry cat, all you do is get on all fours, arch your back, hold for 10 seconds, hang out and breathe,
release.
Right. Round your shoulders, round your back, and so that your lumbar spine's at the highest point, and you do that for 10 seconds. So you do a couple sets of that, and that I can tolerate because there's no pressure on my belly.
I do cat-cows a lot, and I also do cobras because cobras, that I was highly recommended to do cobras.
Cobras you're not supposed to do cobra if you have lumbar stenosis.
Right.
Because that... and also, especially if you have, I have spondylolisthesis, and you don't know if you do, you may. I have spondylolisthesis at L2, L3, and I have a little bit at L5, S1. I'm very fortunate that I have no sciatic pain at all. And at L5, S1, you'd expect to have sciatic pain, and I have none. I've had it in the past, but I do not have it now. But you have to be really careful doing cobras, because cobras, the herniated discs pooch out when you do cobras.
Sure. Well, I have an interesting situation approaching, and that is that my physical therapist who I was using is no longer working at Select.
Oh!
And he is, I'll explain that to you after the show, and but he is working on putting a studio together.
Oh, good.
In town, because he just bought a bike fitting machine.
Nice.
And that he purchased used from someone. And I told him I want to be his first victim because he's a cyclist and he understands the situation I'm in. He's the one who told me I really should be doing a lot more cobras because of my situation with my neck. So, you know, we'll see where that goes.
You have to talk to... Does he know you have lumbar stenosis?
Yeah, I may need another MRI once I visit with my surgeon in July. I think it's July. Yeah. June or July. And ask them about that because they might have me, you know, do that to take a look and make sure that I'm not going to be doing any additional
damage.
And if
you're having cramping south of your lumbar spine, like in your legs and your feet...
Yeah.
You might want to talk to them about getting a lumbar MRI
as well. It's also arms and hands.
That's right. But if it's legs and feet, and legs and feet can be coming from the cervical spine, but it can also be coming from the lumbar spine.
Mm-hmm.
So you might want to have that reviewed. When was the last time you had a lumbar MRI?
Well, I haven't had it since before the surgery, which was over a year ago. Yeah. But when they gave me the full MRI, they said that there was something going on down there, too, that was definitely an issue, but that the cervical issue was far more important to work with, and that there's a possibility that after that was done that I wouldn't have as
much
problem.
So if you
can
go into my chart and get your... get your lumbar MRI. I would like to see that.
Yeah, I can do that.
Yeah, you should do that.
I'll look it up at some point.
Meanwhile, I'll talk about some other stuff,
too. Talk about some other things here, because you've still got some time to go.
Okay, so let's talk about high-tech water consumption encouragement and kidney stones.
Oh, boy.
So there was a study where they used tech to encourage people to drink water, and they found that it didn't prevent kidney stones. Phooey. Kidney stones are no fun. They hurt. They make you sick. So drinking more water. So this is an article from Science Daily, and it said that drinking more water didn't prevent kidney stones. Even high-tech hydration plans couldn't stop kidney stones revealing how tough prevention really is. They are notoriously painful and frustratingly common. Many people have repeat episodes. I am very fortunate in that I only had one once, and I have a small non-obstructing stone in my kidney, and it's staying put. It's not going anywhere, and I only had the kidney stone that one time. And I don't know if it was just a fluke, because I am very careful to stay hydrated, but it's saying that it's really hard to prevent kidney stones any regardless of what you do. But let's see what they say. So there was a great big new study that tested whether a high-tech hydration program with smart water bottles, reminders, coaching, and financial incentives could help people drink enough water to stop the stones from coming back. So kidney stones are known for causing severe, often debilitating pain. They can disrupt daily life and frequently send people to the emergency room. About 1 in 11 people will develop. That's not nothing. So you definitely know people who've had kidney stones. I mean, I myself have had kidney stones, and of course I have numerous patients who've had them. It's pretty common. It's one of the conditions that I see with some regularity. In the United States, 1 in 11 people, and nearly half of them will experience another episode later on. Jeez. So there was a large new clinical trial that was led by the Urinary Stone Disease Research Network and coordinated by Duke Clinical Research Institute. So Duke is in what, North Carolina? Set out to answer a key question: can a structured behavioral program help people drink enough fluids to prevent kidney stones from returning? So the findings that were published recently in The Lancet shed light on why preventing kidney stones remains difficult even when people are motivated and receive ongoing support. The trial results show that despite the importance of high fluid intake to prevent stone recurrence, achieving and maintaining very high fluid intake is more challenging than we often assume for people with urinary stone disease. And so the challenge of adherence likely contributes to the relatively high rate of stone recurrence. So if it's an adherence issue, what I thought was that drinking enough fluids doesn't matter. You're going to get this. If you're predisposed, you're going to get them anyway. Or is it that just people are not adherent to the plan? So smart bottles and coaching still fell short. Here I am drinking my water with electrolytes. Okay. Participants in the study were randomly assigned to either standard care or a behavioral hydration program designed to increase fluid intake. The program included Bluetooth-enabled smart water bottles that tracked how much participants drank. So I'm assuming if they're Bluetooth-enabled, they've got an app on their phone that's telling, like, when they drink, the Bluetooth is transmitting how much water they're drinking to the app. That's really cool. They also had personalized hydration goals, fluid prescriptions. So that's going to be based on activity level, weight, size, all kinds of stuff like that. They gave them financial incentives and health coaching too. Each participant's fluid prescription was calculated by comparing their usual urine output with the amount needed to reach a daily goal of at least 2.5 liters. Although people in the program did increase how much they drank and their average urine output rose, the improvement was not enough to significantly reduce the rate of symptomatic kidney stone recurrence across the entire group. It was the largest behavioral study of its kind. It included almost 1,700 adolescents and adults from 6 major U.S. clinical centers. So from the University of Texas, Washington University in St. Louis, University of Pennsylvania, and CHOP in Philadelphia, University of Washington, that's UW in Seattle, Mayo Clinic and Cleveland Clinic, which are, I guess, one's in Cleveland, one's, of course, Mayo Clinic is in Minneapolis. Researchers followed participants for 2 years to monitor the outcomes, and the study stands out because it directly measured whether kidney stones came back rather than focusing only on fluid intake or urine levels. Researchers used regular surveys and imaging to determine if new stones formed or existing ones grew. Okay, here's a good one. Why staying hydrated is so difficult. The results highlight how hard it can be for people to consistently drink large amounts of fluid every day, even when supported by technology and coaching. The findings suggest that a single hydration target may not work for everyone. Of course not, since fluid needs vary depending on factors such as age, body size, lifestyle, and overall health. That seems obvious.
That's kind of a no-brainer, yeah.
Across adolescents and adults, the study moves the field towards more precise prevention, said Gregory Tazian, who is a co-senior author and attending pediatric urologist at CHOP in Pennsylvania. Rather than asking every patient to meet the same fluid goal, that surprises me. They asked everybody to do the same fluid goal. They should have consulted me. They should have consulted me. I would have told them you have to base it on the person's size and fat body fat content and activity level. There's got to be a whole bunch of factors. Exactly.
Yeah.
So rather than asking every patient to meet the same fluid goal, we should determine who benefits from which targets, understand why adherence breaks down, and build interventions. So what they're suggesting is it was an adherence problem, not a hydration problem. In other words, people were not adhering to the plan. They weren't doing what they were asked to do. Researchers say the findings point to the need for new approaches to prevention, which could include more individualized hydration goals, strategies to overcome barriers related to work and daily routines, and potential treatments that keep minerals dissolved in the urine. So, by the way, there's things that help keep your minerals dissolved in your urine. Like if you have have adequate magnesium in your blood, you're going to be more likely to keep stuff dissolved in your urine. I take magnesium, and certain kinds of magnesium are better absorbed than others. So personally, I take magnesium glycinate, which is well absorbed. It's glycinate malate, actually. And then I take a little bit of magnesium taurate as well. And the taurate, I want to get that little bit of taurine in because that's good for calming my nerves. And I have, I have nerve pain, so I've got a little bit of taurine. And taurine is calming, and so is glycine, actually. So kidney stone disease is a chronic condition. It can be unpredictable, excruciatingly painful. It can disrupt work, sleep, productivity, and life in general. So most people would appreciate a simple means to reduce their chances of experiencing another event. So in addition to the various studies, there are a bunch of practitioners who looked at this. So this study, along with other research from the Urinary Stone Disease Research Network, was funded by the National Institute of Diabetes and Digestive and Kidney Diseases. So you're lucky you've never had a kidney stone, right?
Not yet.
Don't say that.
Well, I say it all the time because I have an expression that ends with WN, and the WN is what's next.
Oh no!
Because it seems like it's always something.
If you've made it to 71 and you haven't had one, there's a chance that you may not.
That would be a nice thing.
Yeah, I wasn't so lucky.
I'm not looking forward to something
like
that.
I also only had it once.
Right.
It's really incredible because you have excruciating back pain and you think that you pulled your back really bad. Frequently you throw up. So I thought when I had mine, I thought that I was sick. I thought I had acute gastroenteritis because it happened while I was at work. Yeah. I was sitting with a patient. I felt really, my back was sore and I felt really nauseous. And I was praying to wrap up with a particular patient. And finally she wrapped up and I had some time afterwards and I lay down on the bed and I was super nauseous and my back hurt. And then I ran for the bathroom and got sick. And then I went to my staff and said, all right, I think I have acute gastroenteritis. You have to cancel the rest of the day. And I went home, got sick some more, and then I lay down on my bed and I writhed in horrible pain. I'm like, why does my back hurt so much? I didn't understand it. And while I was lying there, I lay and writhed after being sick a few times, I lay on my back and writhed for about half an hour, and all of a sudden, thank the Lord, all of a sudden, I felt all better. I was fine. I was suddenly fine. Not only was I fine, I was no longer nauseous. I became hungry and thirsty. And then I said, wait a second, maybe I had a kidney stone. And so I looked up whether, because I had this horrible back pain that suddenly resolved. And, when you pull your back, it doesn't do that usually. And the nausea completely went away as well. And I felt fine. I felt normal. So I said, Suddenly I went, maybe it was a kidney stone. So I looked up to see if you can get nausea and vomiting with kidney stones. And that is absolutely a symptom because you have so much pain and you have pain in, you know, at the same spinal level as that controls your stomach. And also you're in a lot of pain. So you have a vasovagal reaction. So, and then I had the pain and it suddenly resolved. So I said, oh, and I went into the bathroom and there was definitely gravel in the toilet. And then I went back to work and dipped my urine and I had blood. And I said, well, look at that. I guess I had a kidney stone. And so I went to my primary care and he said, okay, we're sending you for a CAT scan. Because since I was completely well, there was no need for me to go to the ER. But he said, I want to send you for a CAT scan to see if there's anything going on in there. And that's when they saw the small non-obstructing stone and no additional stone. So obviously I had passed the stone. And that was that. And that was 2019 and it's now 2026 and I'm good. And I just am very careful to hydrate. And who gets kidney stones? People who are too busy to hydrate. So my friend who's he's a nurse practitioner. He's a PA. He's a physician's assistant and he was working in the ER. And he's younger than me. I don't know if he's 60 yet. So he's in his 40s or 50s. And he was working in the ER. And he's fit. He's not obese. But he's working in the emergency room. And he got a kidney stone while doing that. And, you know, if you're working in the emergency room, self-care can be really, really challenging. So people who work in emergency situations, if they can't hydrate adequately, it really is, hydration is really what helps you. And what they said in the study was not that the hydration doesn't matter. They thought that there was an adherence issue and they didn't get the hydration goals right. So if you hydrate well and you do stuff to keep your calcium oxalate in solution, for example, take magnesium every day and also eat foods that are high in magnesium, you're going to be less likely to get stones. Because, you know, I had it once and I never had it again. Yeah. And I take my magnesium and I'm trying to be really careful to hydrate. And it can be challenging to hydrate during the day when I'm at work because I'm sitting still talking to people, and even though I'm losing a lot of fluids speaking, because I'm constantly speaking, it still can be challenging. And one of the problems I haven't figured out how to like make sure I have cold water on my desk. I have a glass of water on my desk, but I'm not keeping it cold, and I would probably do better to have a container that kept my water cold for me, and I drank from that.
I got you one of those.
I know it, but I think I need one to leave at the office.
I'll get you another one.
I should get another one. That's true.
Right.
Yeah. So maybe I'll do that. I'll get another one and I'll just explain to staff that, I'm going to have to, well, I don't know because, I wanted to have ice in it. So I may have to
don't
take care of my own hydration.
Do you have a refrigerator at the office?
I do have a refrigerator. So that's the thing, but I need to have something on my desk. I need to be, because I can't keep going to the refrigerator to sip, and I need to be able to sip while I'm sitting with the patient.
That wasn't what I was saying. It's like you could keep cold water in the refrigerator.
Well, I do
that. Refill that with, or the other thing is, does your refrigerator have a way of producing ice?
No.
Then you should bring the ice maker that we have here at the house into your office.
And put it where? That's not going to work.
I don't know.
No, that's not going to work. I think it would be the thing to
you
do.
Options,
the thing
all.
To do would be better to have an insulated container that I took care of filling every day with ice and water. That would be the way to do it. And I would just have to schlep it back and forth.
Yeah.
I just have to take my Yeti and just schlep it back and forth to the office. Yeah. So, because I'm more likely to drink it. All right. So that's hydration. It's still true that you want to hydrate as much as you possibly can. All right, so that's kidney stones for you. Let's talk about another interesting thing, and probably a lot of you have this problem, and I may not get to everything you can do about it. I don't have too much time left. So we'll get started on it, and we may have to finish it next week. And that is toenail fungus. Yay, toenail fungus.
Ew.
Well, it comes up this time of year, especially if you're somebody who wears sandals. and, you know, you feel like your toenails are unsightly. And, you know, eventually what I do is I get a pedicure, but while I have the pedicure, I don't want to take care of the toenail fungus because I've got the nail polish on it. You can get antifungal nail polish. That is a thing. So that's something you can do. You can get, if you want to do your own manicure. What would be really cool is if you went to a nail salon and they had antifungal nail polish at the salon, but I've never heard of that. So there are great home remedies for toenail fungus. So toenail fungus can be helped with certain essential oils, stuff with antimicrobial and antifungal properties like, you know, aromatic chest rubs, you know, chest rubs that have essential oil in them that you normally would use if you had a cough or a cold where you breathe the vapors. Those essential oils are antifungal. So toenail fungus is also called onychomycosis. Onychomycosis just means nail fungus. It doesn't specify toe or hand. Onycho is your nails. Mycosis is fungus. And it's also called tinea. So tinea is any fungal infection. And when you have tinea pedis, that's athlete's foot. And tinea unguium is nail fungus. And so I guess you would say tinea unguium pedis because you want to specify that it's in your toes. The thing with toenail fungus is very hard to treat if you live somewhere where you have to wear shoes or if it's a job where you wear shoes. When your feet are enclosed, and I am a foot sweater, not everybody's feet sweat a lot, but my feet sweat and they will sweat even if I'm cold. If my feet are in socks and shoes, they will sweat. So the problem is that fungus loves dark, warm, moist environments. Mm. And these dark, warm, moist environments, that's what you have when you're in socks and shoes. So one great way to get rid of toenail fungus is move to Florida or at least move to the beach, somewhere where you can pretty much be in the water every single day. When I was at the beach in Florida, there are a lot of Russians and Ukrainians that moved to Venice, Florida, and Venice and the surrounding area, because in Northport, Florida, there's a place called Warm Mineral Springs, and there are warm mineral springs that come up, and they have and they go through a particular river there, and they've widened out a patch of it in Northport and made it into a spa, so you can sit on the sides and you can go in the water. And I'm not sure, they used to have like a restaurant and massage and other spa services there. I don't know if they still have that. And it attracted a community of Russians and Ukrainians to move to the area because they are big believers in natural bathing. And I agree with them. I think natural bathing is really good for you. And, you know, the shtetl that I came from and my family came from in the late 1800s, early 1900s, is probably now in either Poland or the Ukraine. And it was in Austria-Hungary. Now it's probably Poland because the borders moved around. So some of these ladies will look at me and they'll start speaking Russian or Ukrainian to me, and I'll have to say, I'm sorry, I don't understand, because I look like them. You know, I don't understand Russian or Ukrainian. But that is what Duolingo is for. But when you go to the beach in Venice, so I didn't go to Warm Mineral Springs, but if you go to the beach in Venice, you'll hear people speaking another language. And if you listen, they're speaking either Russian or Ukrainian. And Russian and Ukrainian are pretty similar. There's some words that are, I think it's similar the way that Portuguese and Italian and Spanish and French are similar. They're, especially Spanish and Portuguese, there's a lot of words that are exactly the same. And there are some words that are really, like when I'm learning Portuguese now on Duolingo, and I'm surprised at how similar the words are. And some of them are the same, like por favor is please in Spanish and Portuguese. Agua, amigo, amiga, same words. And yo for I, it's the same word. It's spelled differently in Portuguese, but it's the same word. Russian and Ukrainian are very similar. So those people really believe in natural bathing. So if you go to the beach, you're going to see people of all ages, doesn't matter their age, in the water, whereas you're not going to see as many American women, especially as they get older, in the water because of vanity or whatever. But the Russian Ukrainian women, there'll be older ladies, and they'll be in the water just bathing, just jumping the waves and hanging out. And one of the things that I found when I was there was that I got into the Gulf almost every day, and it really helped my back and my joints. It really does help. And that was on orders from my chiropractor. He told me, you must get in the salt water. You need to get in the salt water. It's going to really help you. And he was not wrong. And I really made sure to get in, whereas sometimes I go to Florida and I don't get into the water. And I said to myself, you can go and just stay half an hour. You don't, because the thing is, it's 10 minutes from my mother's house. It's not like when you live in New Jersey and when you live in New Jersey, it's a whole production to get to the beach. You know, you could drive for 10 minutes and you can get in for half an hour and get out and come back tomorrow and go do something else that day. So anyway, that was my promotion of getting in salt water. And getting in salt water is also helpful for any fungal conditions you have. Walking on the water's edge with the sand is also helpful. So I am going to talk about how to help your toenail fungus next week, next time I make a show. So I am going to wrap up at this point, and the unofficial start of summer is coming up soon, the weekend that's coming. So please enjoy your Memorial Day weekend, whatever happens. I hope that we get some good weather. All right, so I'm going to let you go. You have been listening to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician, with my co-host Ron Meniza. You can email me with questions and comments at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to this show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, Spotify, Patreon, Buzzsprout, and YouTube. You may also watch the recorded Facebook Live episode at Fran Storch ND for 30 days. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. The information presented on the show should not be construed as medical advice or direction. If you're having a medical condition, please consult with your physician. Thank you for listening to Radio Naturopath, your show where you can learn about the best of science and nature. We'll be back with more Radio Naturopath next week at 91.7 FM. WHUS stores and WHUS.org. Thank you so much for listening.